Blog Talk Radio.
923, I'll give you a corrected address, but you have a fire in a one-story ordinary, looks like it's about 40 by 120, 125. Get your traffic control, squad 5. Over to 273, 273.
You're listening to Street Smart Shop Talk with Save Firefighter LLC. Whether you're from the sticks or the bricks, discuss the latest topics in the fire service with the crew of Save Firefighter. We'll talk about how strategies, tactics, and current events affect you on the fire ground. We want you to be a smart, aggressive, fundamental, and efficient firefighter. Get it done, no excuses.
The 4,600-page Granger Catalog. Every solution on earth for every problem under the sun. And now, it fits in your pocket. Download the app today. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Granger.com, or stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
All right. Welcome to Street Smart Shop Talk on Fire Engineering Talk Radio. My name is Matt McDowell. I'm joined tonight by Jason Janitas. We are broadcasting from the Irmo Fire Headquarters in Columbia, South Carolina. We got a good show for you guys tonight. Real quick, I need to thank everybody out there that is tuned in right now. We greatly appreciate it. Obviously, we couldn't do what we do without you. We need to thank Fire Engineering for giving us the chance to do this, and we need to thank our host, Granger, for making all of this a possibility. So we're always very gracious for that. Real quick, before we get in to everything, we're going to go over some of the events we have on the horizon. We have a pretty busy next couple months. September 6th, we have Fire Ground Search and Fire Ground Survival Refresher at Goose Creek, South Carolina. September 12th, we have our four-hour Street Smart Forceful Entry 1. And that is actually going to be at the 2014 Charlotte Firefighters 9/11 Memorial Stair Climb. So we're very honored to have been invited to teach especially our flagship class at such an important event. So that is Street Smart Forceful Entry 1 at the 2014 Charlotte Firefighters 9/11 Memorial Stair Climb. Now, I can say that the stair climb itself has already sold out, but registration for the hands-on and lecture classes is live, I think, as of today, and you can find the link to the registration on our Facebook page, facebook.com/savefirefighter. September 23rd is our next episode of Street Smart Shop Talk right here on Fire Engineering Talk Radio. And October 4th, we're going back to Goose Creek for Fire Ground Search and Fire Ground Survival. And then November 1st and 2nd, we are actually going to the Low Country Fire EMS Weekend in Walterboro, South Carolina. And we will be doing our Street Smart engine work. So that's going to be an 8-hour hands-on, just down and dirty engine class. And we're doing that, we're doing 2 8-hour days. So you'll have the chance to take that class on either Saturday or Sunday. That is November 1st and 2nd at the Low Country Fire EMS Weekend in Walterboro. All right, that being said, we'll just go ahead and roll right into talking about truck belts. So please bear with us. We're having a little bit of technical difficulties tonight, so I think we had some we may have had a little blank time there. So please bear with us. So the evolution of the truck belt. When I first heard about what a truck belt was, I actually knew it as a spanner belt, which is actually of my dad's spanner belt or truck belt for about the first 5 years that I was on the job. So it's pretty interesting, you know, how, you know, essentially a spanner belt was just a cool, just salty leather belt that carried the stuff that either couldn't or wouldn't fit in your pockets. And then, you know, now it's kind of strange because for me personally, as I continued to take training, kind of travel around, you know, then you had, I guess to me the next evolution was the gut belt, which I actually carry on, which I actually wear on my bunker pants today. But they used it, when I learned about it, they used it pretty much in the same context as an old truck belt. They would put stuff on there that was pretty much just fire specific. So whenever they were going to fires, they would strap on the belt and it had their search bags or their bailout bags. It had, I'm actually looking at an old school one right now. We'll talk more about it in a minute. It had a holder for a tool, maybe some spanner wrenches, you know, just useful stuff that was kind of mission specific to fires. And then, you know, we've seen, especially in the last few years, especially after the tragedy in FDNY on Black Sunday, the evolution and the, I guess, the prioritization of being able to escape from above ground, from upper floors. So we've seen a lot of training and, I'm looking for
development
and emphasis put on harnesses and the training with them, and a lot of equipment has come out with them. So we're going to kind of talk a little bit about all that stuff. So I guess I'll ask JJ, in your career, have you or what have you used as far as an accessory belt? Or to be honest with you, I've even referred to them myself as a bat belt.
The bat belt?
The bat belt. What kind of bat belts have you used in your career?
I had the old Boston leather leather belt, and I wore it for a while, and I passed it on to a guy when I went to training. I left it for old Kobe. And now I currently have, you know, the Geminer harness, the most popular harness, on my gear. I'm lucky enough, I work for a department that we're outfitting our ladders and eventually our rescues with the Class 2 harnesses built into our gear.
Okay. Have you ever used, like when you use your Boston leather belt, what did you use it for? Like what was on it?
I carry pretty much the axe, you know, and, you know, it was one of those things that I had heard, and all those salty truck guys always wore one, and you're like, I want to be one of those guys, and that's why I wore it, you know. Just, but I also knew, you know, you could clip your helmet onto it for kind of hands-free, and, you know, you can hold a lot of things in it, especially, like, the axe and the halligan you can flip on in there to hold on to it.
Yeah, I have the leather truck belt. Mine wasn't a Boston truck belt. Matter of fact, I'm not even sure if it was technically I have a feeling it was kind of repurposed. I want to say that it was Atlas brand. And I remember this because, as I mentioned, I got it from my dad, and he actually, I actually have a picture of my dad wearing it at a fire, and he's got a flashlight hanging off of one side, and he's got a spanner wrench hanging on the other side, and so that was kind of like my baseline. So I knew that, you know, for the most part, if I had a trucking belt, the gentleman was like, look, your light needs to be hands-free.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you have other toys or accessories, you need to have them where you can get to them, but they're not in your way and they're not taking up space in other places where you need it. Of course, you know, back in the day, you know, coats didn't, you know, our gear didn't have the enormous pockets that it has now. You know, so for him, it was definitely a necessity. But by the same token, he didn't carry it probably quite as much other carry today either. So
right. The
bat belt was pretty much what he had. But what was cool about my bat belt was it actually had the manufacturer tag on it still, which is actually stamped metal, so it's held up over time, and it was manufactured in either 74 or 76. I can't remember now because I'm on the spot. So it's pretty cool to know that you know, now that truck belt's been in our family for 40 years. And now I've actually since retired it because of evolution of all the other of our bags of tricks, but I actually still have that same light. Because, you know, my dad's like me, it's sentimental because he fought fire with it, right?
Right.
So he actually kept a hold of the light also. So now I've got it kind of set up the same way that they had in that picture hanging on my wall. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I upgraded to a gut belt. And the gut belt to me is pretty similar to that old school truckie belt, which is probably why from a sentimental standpoint, I still like to use it. Plus, in the low country, we don't have a lot of high rises. So, you know, the need for a quote-unquote bailout harness is a little bit lower down my neck of the woods. I did wear one for a while, but, you know, it is what it is. I seem to get more use out of my gut belt, just using it almost more as a truck belt.
Right.
That I can bail out on if necessary, and it's set up for that also. So, I'm sitting here looking, and I'm curious to know, I'm looking at this pile of belts and this cool stuff, and I'm looking at axe scabbards, and I'm kind of curious to know from anybody out there in blog land or podcast land, who all uses or has used or what your thoughts are on axe scabbards. Do you prefer to carry your axes in your hand? Do you like to have the ability for them to be kind of hands-free? What are your thoughts, JJ?
Well, I know from some of the West Coast guys that I've run into in classes and friendships and connections, those guys out West love those hand-free scabbards. They love those axes. I think I currently know someone at Columbia that kind of wears one and throws the axe in the belt. I actually know a couple people, and, I mean, it definitely works. Hands-free, you have it right there by the side. And even if you don't have a actual belt, an axe is probably the best tool to put in your SCBA waist strap if you don't have anything at all.
Yep. Yeah, and, you know, we always talk about, you know, everybody can always use an extra set of hands on a fire because everybody can always use more staffing, you know. And even though, you know what, I'm a firm believer in quote-unquote hand tools, you know, carry them, they're there, they're in your hands, they're useful, whatever. You know, I know that in a staffing minimal type of situation, it might be important if you have to multitask to be able to just, you know what, yeah, carrying the irons married, you know, to some might be ideal, but there might be a good case where just being able to just separate that 8 pounds from that set
right.
and carry just a Halligan and still have one extra hand might be nice, you know. And there's performers out there who don't necessarily even carry a married on the rigs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you may have to just kind of piecemeal it together or whatever. So, so I'm curious to know out there what you guys do. So feel free to give us a shout on the show, or we are on Facebook and Twitter right now too. So chime on in. That being said, in the meantime, I've seen even people who you talk about, you know, in conversation, you talk about, oh, well, you know, what tool should I carry, blah, 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 and I'm like, and you bring up the idea of wearing a belt or marrying tools or strapping things together or whatever, and some of the guys are kind of like, well, you know, I kind of silly to want to do that, and then you see them, like, at a training or at a fire, and they have a tool tucked into their SCBA waist belt. And it just kind of makes me curious to know, you know, well, maybe there's something to this truck belt thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we were having a conversation earlier about one of the problems why maybe the harnesses have kind of taken over as far as that family combination of having huge pockets now.
Right.
And the harness is on your pants, so your coat pockets are kind of, you know, it may depend on how you spec your gear, but your coat pockets are accessible, and your harness is accessible also. I know that, you know, when I came into the fire service, short coats and high pants were kind of the fad. I mean, you had to go out of your way to find anything longer than a 32-inch coat, and then the tails came out, you know, from Pride, and then everybody else kind of jumped on that bandwagon.
Yep.
But there was a time period where your waist strap kind of came right across your coat pockets. You know, so if that's still your problem, maybe a solution might be to kind of wear a truck belt, you know, kind of lower on your hips.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can have a little bailout kit on one side, have a tool holder or a flashlight on the other side, and, you know, that might be a way to kind of bring it back a little bit. So,
yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that I like, oh, the harness over the truck belt, and I will, you know, go with, I am a fan of the harness now, it's one that's built a few years where you're going to have to take that additional step of putting it on, and it's the risk back opportunities, or I want the opportunities, the technique and other type of, you know, opportunities, I guess would be the word, is, you know, converting an air pack with a built-in harness, doing a drag with the harness compared to the truck belt. You know, obviously, you know, that doesn't work out as
well. Well, yeah, and, you know, that's actually a really good point is, and we actually do talk about it in some of our bailout classes, and when we start talking about the use of truck belts and harnesses, is a lot of people, you know, and you know, again, I make do with a gut belt. But again, it's not necessarily about what you use as much as knowing how to use what you have. And so, you know, if you have a large carabiner on your gut belt or your harness, there are ways that even if you don't or aren't planning on, which nobody's obviously planning on bailing out of the building, there are a lot of other functions for it. Victim rescue, firefighter rescue. You can use it in, you know, some, you know, for whatever. I mean, it can be something as simple
as low angle,
i.e. for, you know, vehicles down embankments. You can just make kind of like the human anchor just to kind of help guide that crew back up. There are some trade-offs, you know, but again, you know, that old school mentality, as I actually look at a truck belt that one of the guys here from Irmo actually got from Chief Mundy, which, again, to me is kind of one of the coolest things about the whole thing is, you know, I got my truck belt from my dad, and it was an honor for me to get that, you know, and, you know, for Chief Mundy to pass down his truck belt to Aaron Hatfield, who was who wasn't here, he had to step out. And Aaron told me, you know, that was Chief's truck belt from when he was with Des Moines.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, what, 35, 40 years ago?
At least.
You know, and the honor, you know, that it is to kind of have that. But then again, you look at Chief Money's truck belt from 40 years ago.
Looks good.
And it'll rival anything that you can kind of come up with now. I mean, there's nothing on his truck belt that isn't, you know, that isn't, you know, front and center on the modern fire ground. Now, obviously, you know, Chief just retired a couple of years ago, so he may have had some modern upgrades. But yeah, it's just pretty cool. So it's about knowing what you have, knowing how to use it. If you like truck belts, then you know what? Awesome. You know, it's and actually, JJ had mentioned, and I forgot to bring it up, but JJ mentioned our friends on the West Coast, and actually Aaron has since upgraded or just changed his setup. He actually now carries a leather truck belt made from Fire Axe Incorporated off the West Coast with a Fire Axe scabbard, and he carries a Fire Axe in it. And for those who have never seen a Fire Axe Incorporated axe, it's pretty awesome. It's if nothing else, it's a cool looking piece of firefighting equipment.
Flathead Fire Axe?
Yeah.
Definitely the best, one of the best axes around.
It's very cool. So, JJ and I are actually sitting here and we're looking at a pile of belts, and it just kind of reiterates the fact that, you know, whether you want a truck belt, an old school leather truck belt, whether you want a gut belt style, whether you're a class 2 harness guy, or whether you just want a big fat piece of leather with a giant boss buckle on it to carry your axe around in and just look like a hardcore West Coast truckie. Whatever your flavor, as long as you know how to use it, I think JJ and I agree, whatever you want to do, as long as when it's time to do work,
yep, you know how to use it.
You get it done, then it's cool to us. All right, cool. All right. So that being said, we're going to take another quick break, and we're going to get into sizing up hose lines and ladders.
With over 100,000 safety products, it makes me wonder, did Granger write the book on workplace safety? Get your copy today. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Granger.com, or stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, we're back. So now we're going to roll into talking about sizing up the hose stretch. Hose estimates are very much a dying art. If not, with all due respect to those who still do it, dead art, as far as on a larger scale. You know, if your department has dead load beds, more power to you. I think, you know, if that's what you're doing, that's awesome. But obviously, if that's how your department rolls, then you know that there is some training that goes along with that, which is kind of the lead-in part of this is, you know, in recruit schools and in any kind of fire training and on all of our apparatus, you know, a lot of times when we're trained on pulling hose, it's the same line every time. It's our fire truck carries this much hose, it's in this place, and this is how you pull it. You know, we've got a 150 and a 200, and for a lot of people, that's it. Okay? I know that where I work, you know, we have a lot of restricted driveways, long driveways. I actually ran a reported house fire my last shift, and we kind of stopped at the driveway and said, you know what? My decision was, if we don't commit to beaching the engine, we're not going to get there with hose, at least in any kind of reasonable time. It was a huge house and a long driveway. But again, you've got to know how to make that decision. And a lot of firefighters, at least what I found, and JJ, have you found the same thing to be true? that young firefighters being able to guesstimate how much hose they actually need.
They're horrible at it. Not in mine. From what I've seen and across, and I'm not just speaking on my department's behalf, on the engine class that we've taught so far, you know, everyone talks about the lost art and the lost art of, you know, truck company and true trucks and all that. The lost art of engine skills, I truly believe it's the hose stretching. There aren't many people that I've truly met that can look at a house and stand and say, all right, if I need to get to the second floor, I'm going to get about, whatever, 300 feet, 200 feet. Now I understand, you know, I can play devil's advocate. Well, I haven't been in that house. I don't know how the, interior design is, and I understand that. But you got to know at least what it is to the front door, plus that. You have to know. And people these days especially, that's a skill, especially when it comes to engine companies. Guys are horrible, horrible at knowing the length of stretches, you know. And the fact of the matter is partly our fault, because how many people have truly laid out 200 feet in a line and said, all right, you're at the pump panel, this is how far 200 feet of hose will go, or 300 feet, or 150 feet, whatever your crosslays are. The ones we use at Columbia are 200 feet. But have you ever stood in a parking lot with nothing around and stretched a 200-foot line straight out? And so that's what 200 feet looks like. And then you go to, say, an abandoned house or something. I'm sure there are plenty of abandoned houses in everyone's area. You stretch out that same 200 feet around the house, and you say, all right, that's what 200 feet looks like. And again, it's all muscle. It even goes back to, you know, brain memory or muscle memory. You got to know what you're looking at before you can start, you know, truly making that guess. Because I know we all know, you know, you say, hey, I know that's 150 feet, and you stretch 150 feet and fall short, everyone's going to say something to you. So, you know, again, it's one of the things you got to train on it and know your distances. I know the other day you posted a picture on Facebook from a fire, I believe it was in Manhattan or the Bronx. Anyway, one of the guys...
Was that the apartment?
Had the bleach bottle.
Yes,
you
yeah.
Know, everyone knows, early, you know, those bleach bottles are notorious on engines up there for tearing the rope with, you know, knowing your knots. And same thing, we just implemented a huge search rope training at Columbia, and our knots are 25 feet. So, you know, deploy the search rope, you know, engine one, this is ladder, whatever, you know, we're three knots in, that's 75 feet to the fire room door. That engine knows right off the bat, you know, 100 feet, I'm in the fire room.
Absolutely, and you know, that's, and again, not understanding the importance of sizing up the hose line can really cause you to find yourself in a pretty big bind. And usually and typically, it's not when you're in an ideal position to be in a bind. It's usually, you know, most of the time when you realize that you stretch short. It's usually when you really wish you had that extra section of hose.
Oh, yeah.
And usually, since you can't go forward, that usually results in you having to go backwards. And obviously, nobody likes to go backwards at a fire. We don't like doing it. The public surely didn't call us to not have enough hose to put the fire out. So let's talk about some of the problems with inaccurate hose estimates. First and foremost, if you don't have enough line, that problem is kind of self-explanatory. You can't put the fire out.
Right.
So they pretty much called you for nothing. Now, obviously, that's a problem that we can fix. But again, you know, we preach being very professional at our jobs, being mentally, physically prepared to do that job, and part of being mentally and physically prepared to do engine work is being mentally able to size up a hose stretch and physically able to get it there, whether that's stretching a pre-connect, whether it's adding sections, whether it's using a leader line with a gated line and coming off of that. You know, you talk to a lot of guys and they're like, so favorite question, you have a fire right there. What are three ways to get a line there? inevitably, if it's anything above ground, somebody says, well, I'm going to pull a gated Y up there, and okay, cool. When was the last time you trained on that? You know, it's easy to say, this is what I'm going to do. But if you don't, I'm going to back up. But a lot of times, I also say, okay, so how much hose do you think that's going to take? Well, I'm not real sure. We'll talk more about that in a second. So I'm like, okay, so I'm like, let's just say, hypothetically speaking, it's going to take 300 feet of hose. What all components do you have to use in your setup to get 3-inch hose with a gated Y and 1¾-inch hose up to where you need it?
Right.
You know, have you practiced deploying your standpipe packs in apartment landings as opposed to in stairwells, you know, where you can flake it up the stairs? Well, now you're in a landing. What does that look like for your organization? You know, how are you going to get, you brought up the bleach bottle, how are you going to get that 3-inch line to where you're going to go?
Right.
Is it in a static bed that you have to shoulder load? Because just like pulling a nozzle, if you're going to grab the gated line and run, you're going to find yourself in a whole heap of trouble.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
and you bring up the next point is, I'm glad, you know, your company, you guys may be on top of it and say, yeah, I'm going to pull this gated Y or whatever your mechanism of getting the additional line is, and then we're going to pull the higher X pack. Well, what happens when you start doing that? And let's just say you don't have to be in a large apartment. You can have multiple companies, or it takes you that long to get on scene, and a second company arrives. Do they know exactly what you're doing, or do they know what the next step is, where they can help you, or... It's, you know, not just your company at this point, especially on, like, say, apartment fires. Hopefully you have multiple companies coming eventually.
Yeah.
Does the second and third company know what you're doing and know where they can be in place to help you or deploy the line? Just because your company knows, hey, we're going to pull this 2.5 to 3-inch line wherever, you know, what happens if the second new engine pulls up as you're doing that? Could they grab the high-rise pack or whatever mechanism we have of stretching and finishing out? Could they help you finish it out quickly? Because, again, we all know fires are fast now, and the faster we get water on fire, the faster our problems go out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I guess when we start to talk about not necessarily complicated lines, but more complicated hose stretching, where we're talking about multiple components, multiple moving parts. We got to get 3-inch to get a Y. We got to get our hose packs or high-rise packs or standpipe packs or whatever you call them, shoulder packs. Then you got to communicate that to the IC. Then you got to communicate that to the second dude. A lot of departments have, like, backup line policies. So now, where are the backup lines coming from? You know, and what's the reflex time on that?
Right.
And you actually brought up a really good point about fast water. You know, and it's usually the point that I start to bring up when we get into this conversation is, if you know that it's going to be a long stretch, ultimately what's going to be faster? For you to add hose, you know, just kind of paint the picture. You have a fire on the third or fourth floor of a garden apartment, okay? Just to make it fair for our list of options, we'll say that it's an open-air garden apartment with balconies instead of enclosed entryway, okay? Just to have a whole bag of tricks available to us. At the end of the day, what's going to be faster for your crew to pull that pre-connect that they honestly, just to be brutally honest, the one that they pull at all trainings.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And if nothing else, they can get it off the rig quick.
Right.
And then to add on with the standpipe packs or whatever you call them, or to undertake an operation that you probably, hopefully you have, but realistically haven't drilled on to the extent a proficiency of your everyday line. So now we're going to a serious situation, and you're asking for something that we're not particularly well drilled in.
Right.
And expecting a really good result.
Well, it doesn't usually work out pretty good, usually.
No. Again, the key to that is training, you know, because a lot of us, generally speaking, we always like to stick in our comfort zone when we go to drills. I was just having a conversation with one of our training captains about, you know, maybe the next time we go to my fire train, maybe we park a buggy 200 feet from the burn building and say, oh, it's a restricted driveway, or, oh, it's an alley. This is as close as you can get.
That's funny you say that, because we just finished live mud multi-unit drills at Columbia, and one of the other training captains, Captain Dupree, came up with the scenarios. He did a heck of a job running them. And one of the scenarios, we have, again, 200-foot, inch-three-quarter cross blades, which, you know, our bread and butter, easy house fires. We had three working house fires tonight as I was listening to the radio. And he set up barriers 170 feet away from our burn building. So, you know, you'll be very surprised how many people, even having the barriers, were still pulling the 200 and not doing. Now, we had some great companies that were like, no problem, we train on it all the time, we have a lot of apartments. They pulled, you know, we call it a gate pull, because we have two and a half. We don't have that luxury 3-inch hose. But you'll be very surprised on how many people just pulled the regular 200-foot crossway, and they made it to the front door, and that was it.
Yeah.
But that's how the drills were set up. We had about 9 to 12 scenarios, and the company picked which scenario. It may have been an exposure. We had a couple of vehicle fires in front of the live burn building, so you actually had a vehicle burning in front of the live burn building. And, you know, you'll be surprised how many people forgot about the vehicle burning and just took care of the house fire. And I was like, well, that kind of, you guys still have to address that issue, but every other company that arrived forgot about the vehicle fire burning. And we watched the vehicle burn for about 15 minutes until finally someone put some water on it.
But that also kind of goes to, like, that whole thing goes to the importance of training outside your comfort zone, especially when you're going to a comfortable place, like your department's training center.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I know the building, I know the layout,
right.
You know, and a lot of us getting that go in, you go right.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to go put this fire out. Our burn building has two burn rooms.
Either burning on the left or the
you're
left.
You're either going left or you're going right up the stairs and then right again.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So yeah, again, not knocking, but we're actually, you know, but just kind of trying to reinforce the importance of diversity in your training. You know, drive around your district and say, all right, cool. Just pull up in front of the building and say, all right, top floor fire, rear apartment. How much line?
Yeah.
And it's interesting to hear the diversity in the answers. But again, you know, one of the questions that I frequently ask, you know, some of our guys that come from other stations, guys that, you know, that I haven't been able to work with in the recruit school setting, because I know that our recruits, you know, now our recruits get this training, and that's how it ties up the line. So I posted it's not really a link, because to be honest with you, I don't have access to the fire engineering archives, but there is a phenomenal article if you can somehow get a hold of it, and I will try to actually, I may have like copies of it, and I'm going to try to scan the article and post it if I can get the permission to fire engineering. But it is Stretching and Advancing Hand Lines Part 1, which is written by the late, great Andy Fredericks, which reminds me, next month, Andy Fredericks Training Days is coming up in the D.C. metro area. So if you have a chance to check that out, if it's not already sold out, I would definitely do that. That's a phenomenal event. That being said, this article was one of many articles that he wrote, but it specifically talks about sizing up the hose stretch, and it kind of walks you through, you know, different mentalities that he would bring in New York City based on the types of occupancies. Like they knew that if it was, you know, this type of building and it was this floor, given what they knew about their area, then he knew that you needed at least this many to start. And that article is a very detailed article. It's a great read. You can get a lot of good stuff out of it. So please try to find it. And in the meantime, I will try to get it into a decent format to share it on our website, safefirefighter.com. And obviously I'll post a link to that on Twitter and Facebook. So please check that out. In the meantime, one of the methods that I was taught that I share, just because I feel like it's pretty simple and it's pretty universal for your jurisdiction, it's like this. First of all, think of sizing up lines in terms sections of hose or lengths of hose instead of feet. You know, a lot of times we talk about pull the 300-foot line or it's 200 feet, it's this many feet. Mentally, it's easier to wrap your head around visualizing roughly how many feet of hose it is from point A to point B. This is thinking, well, is it 30 feet or is it 40 feet? Because that's kind of hard to see. But again, if you're dropping line on the ground in training, a lot of times you can visually say, okay, well, that's at least one section wide, one section deep, whatever. Or I need at least this many sections to get there. So starting at the engine, how many sections to get from the engine to the front door? Okay, and obviously, hopefully, that may be a little bit longer if you're leaving room for the truck.
Yep.
So consider that also, which is another consideration. If your houses have a lot of setbacks and you're good at positioning for the truck, if that's how you roll on a regular basis, and you probably already considered this. But if you're like kind of getting into the aerial business and you're trying to get your trucks a good spot out front, remember that's going to add length to those lines. So from the engine to the front door, and then generally speaking, how many sections wide is the house and how many sections deep is the house? So if it's two sections wide, one section deep, then that's four sections. If it took you two to get to the front door, then you're at six total sections. Okay? Again, that's crash course. And then for every flight of stairs, you add a section.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the most basic, you know. And obviously, if you read the Andy Fredericks article, I mean, he goes into a lot more detail. But also, you've got to consider your staffing level when you're doing this stuff too. You know, I think most will agree that New York City has a fairly unique hose stretching situation, which they're obviously extremely good at. So, but they're also very well trained and very experienced. So, Jay, you're going to add something?
Well, I was going to say, and they have a great staffing package.
Yeah. Let's see. So again, that's I guess my crash course in sizing up the hose stretch. One thing we have not talked about are the repercussions of stretching short. Okay, which again to me kind of runs parallel to the importance of knowing how to advance, or how to add length. If we estimate on the outside, then we can add our lines on the outside. We can get our lines on the ground, make our connections, get them on our shoulders and advance in, or whatever the case is, from the outside in. To me, and we had some guys, and really and truly, they were in the right place at the right time with the wrong line. And had they, and the communication process was happening, but they were one section short, and they had a fairly close call. They held at the top of the stairs as long as they could, It was a fire in a large house, McMansion, if you will, because that's a very, you know, or hopefully becoming a well-known modern term. Lightning strike fire. Most would say that it's the attic, but in this neighborhood, this is a upper-class neighborhood, big house. You know, the attic was kind of a knee wall kind of thing around all the rooms that were on the top floor. And got to the fire room door, which was, it was rocking and rolling when they got there. And then they ran out of line. I was second due officer. They radioed out and said, hey, we're short, so you need a longer stretch and bring us some. Copy that. Unfortunately, in that case, they weren't able to hold because the conditions got too bad. And we ended up losing a lot more of the house because of it. You know, fortunately, those guys got out. They were all pretty happy when they got to the bottom of the stairs that they weren't upstairs anymore. And it made for a pretty long afternoon. But, and that's kind of the ripple effect of that is, you know, even if you have to advance lines, you know, now all of a sudden everything comes to a screeching halt. You get there, you're clicking, it's bread and butter, bread and butter, bread and butter, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, snap. Now what? You know?
Should have pulled more line.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
But then if, you know, but then you get into that split decision, okay, do we hold our position and hope that the second dude can get up here with a longer line in time? Or do we back out and punt? You know, in that particular case, they tried both. But let's say that you are inside and it is a situation where you get that line in time to actually get it set up, you know. Have you drilled in extending lines inside of confined areas, in a hallway, in an occupied house with furnishings and, you know, all that stuff? Are your packs set up to do that? Because, you know, some packs are brilliantly set up for deploying in stairwells, but might not be worth a crap in a room,
yeah.
You know. And can you do it all under probably intensifying heat conditions, diminishing visibility conditions, and the stress. So, JD, do you get any add on that?
That's what I'm smooth for. So,
reach
or, well, reach, and, you know, if you happen, I don't know what you carry, but if you happen to have smooth board and you need to extend, you could be flowing water until that additional line gets up there,
yep.
Drop the tip down, immediately connect the line, open up the first nozzle, and there you go, you got water. And what we talked about, if you train on it, 15,
mm-hmm.
20 seconds, literally, that quick,
yep.
Drop the tip, connect the coupling, open up the nozzle, and there you go, you're flowing water. But again, you got to have that right equipment, and you got to train on it.
Yeah.
Hopefully you make that stretch properly in the first time. Again, you don't know what kind of conditions are inside. There may be something that you don't expect.
Yeah, and that's kind of the really and truly when you are looking at setting up your hoses, you've got to look at also what are you going to use them for? You know, our purpose packs, which I'm actually going to throw a link on Twitter of a YouTube video of my department's hose pack system. Is your hose pack system or standby system or whatever you want to call it built for keeping water flowing as long as possible until it's time to switch over to your advancing line? And that's actually one of the things that, you know, when we researched our hose packs, we revamped them probably 5 or 6 years ago now. That was one of the things that we looked at heavily was most of the time when we used our hose packs, it was to extend lines at fires because our longest pre-connect is 200 foot, like most departments. But we have a lot of occasions where 300 foot would be a lot more ideal. So, you know, we've got 2-inch and 3-quarter packs that are set up to assist us in that. So I'm going to throw a link on Twitter, which will shoot it to Facebook and all that good stuff. I'm trying to multitask. It doesn't always work out well. But what our system does is it utilizes breakaway nozzles. If you're inside, you're fighting a fire, you can actually get our hose packs completely laid out, and you have a new nozzle already attached to a line sitting next to the nozzle that's in service. You can get everything, get all your couplings where you need them, get them ready, and then you just have to shut down real quick, which, again, is another drill. Do you train on either, A, coordinating with your drivers, relying on awesome radio systems to communicate with your drivers to shut off and then restart water? Do you practice techniques to secure your own water while your interior? You know, there are a couple of techniques that are out there. And again, the name of the game, especially in that case, is minimal time without water, because the fire's not going to stop burning. That's one guarantee. And, you know, what we've learned from the research is that unchecked fire is not a friend of ours. Now, my area, we have a lot of open floor plans, so confining fire, you know, fire has a lot of room to run where we are, you know. So our ability to keep water flowing as long as possible, to keep that protection, is huge. Like I said, I just put that video on Twitter and Facebook, so you can check that out. For standpipe operations, the benefit of having that breakaway nozzle is it's a TFT breakaway nozzle, which, you know, Akron makes one, Elkhart makes one, so whatever. But it's actually a breakaway nozzle with a fog tip, but it's got an integrated smooth bore. But the fog tip has its own shutoff.
Right.
So you can literally, if you have to extend the standpipe pack, you can literally start water all the way up to the breakaway nozzle, shut it down, spin the fog tip off, reopen the smooth bore and fight fire while you're putting the fog tip onto the line that you're extending with. And then now your smooth bore is essentially a gate valve. It sends water back up to the fog tip, and you turn back on, and you're back to doing work. Again, I mean, that's not everybody has the luxury of saying, hey, let's go replace all of our nozzles. But truth be told, for whatever it's worth, at the time, and it may have been a volume discount, but at the time, we got a better price per nozzle for that nozzle, which essentially is two nozzles in one, than what our standard crossway nozzles work.
Right.
So sometimes putting in a little bit of extra legwork kind of works out. So anyway, really what that goes to is just putting thought into what you're using, why you're using it, what its purpose is, playing devil's advocate as far as, you know, what are the situations that I could get into where I might need to change our plan of attack, sometimes literally. And is the equipment set up in a way that is going to allow me to do that safely and effectively? And if not, what are we going to do to make it better? That could be as simple as drilling, getting better at doing the things you do every day, anticipating other problems, looking at the buildings in your first do, or it could be as simple as just making good decisions right off the rip, you know, getting to that building, practice sizing up hose stretches. You know, think about it. Driving your first do, you know. spend a little bit less time looking at the cars next to you and more time looking at the building, you know? Hey, if we're going to stretch a line, how long does it need to be? If we get a fire in this point, you know, at this point, is the front door even the best place? You know, we are so programmed to go in the front door, which is, you know, which we advocate, you know, for lots of reasons in the residential setting. But in a commercial setting, that might not be the best plan, you know. So, and even sometimes in the residential setting, there might be a circumstance where that might not be the best option. So even if 99% of the time you're going in the front door, what are you doing about the 1%? Because that 1% call is going to be the one that comes around and bites you. And, you know, as it has to a lot of our brothers and sisters throughout history. So practice your hose estimates, drill, 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 and learn your equipment. It's pretty much the gist of I think, that part. So, all right. JJ, do you have anything to add?
No.
Okay. Aaron Hatfield's back with us now. We're telling you about all of his truck belts. He is back with us. You missed your spiel about the truck belts. We talked about all of the truck belts. And you weren't sure.
Probably talking about stretches. Yeah. We actually, in my department, we're actually talking about having to reset up our response due to, on commercial or apartment fires, we send two ladder companies and an engine company out of our station. And I brought it up to my battalion chief of shift that a lot of our apartments in the back end of the apartments, the doors are all the way around the back side. And when we come in to park the apparatus, the stretch is over 300 feet. And we do not carry 300 feet cross lays or dead lays on our trucks. So another option came up to, well, we can stretch 3-inch to a gate on a Y and go from there with hose pack. Well, we also don't carry 3-inch on our trucks either. So now we're having to revamp instead of running two truck companies, two apartment fires out of our one station. We're looking at taking an engine and truck and then having to call mutual aid for another truck company. So getting out in your area and learning it is a big deal, because that's how we were going to do it until I noticed the other day on just a regular alarm call that our stretches were well over 300 feet and they were not going to work out. So area familiarization is a big, big thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's and especially if you've been in your areas for a long time, it's very easy to just kind of sit back on the rides, two calls, phone calls, and sit there and kind of get caught up in talking about what firefighters talk about, going to and from things, and kind of lose track of all the information and that you can just absorb just by looking out the windows, you know. I found that even riding backwards was probably one of the best views to look at your first do, because, you know, you see things as you're driving away, you actually have to look at them longer, you know. And you go, that's kind of a weird door. Hey, why don't we swing back around and go check the thing out real quick, you know. Especially if you're riding backwards, you're going to be making the hose stretch.
You're going to want to be doing the work.
So it behooves you to pay attention to what's going on around you. Because I know, as an officer, obviously, you know, with our staffing, which, you know, I think our staffing is very good, but I still put a lot of the responsibility on my firefighter. Like, look, we pull a line, you know, I'm going to tell you, basically, if I tell you how long it needs to be, basically, I need to just be reinforcing what you already know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we drill on you, hey, your job is to get that line off the rig. If we need more, you know, if we're on a 3, then I'll get that. If we're on a 4, then he'll get that. You know, but it's, what does that coordination look like? You know, and again, you learn that when you're out on non-emergent calls, when you're out getting groceries, you're out just out, you know, when you're doing pre-fire plans, you know, yeah, we got the paperwork to go along with it. That's a free ticket to walk through every single business in your district.
Every fire alarm is a free plan.
Yeah.
Free one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Every medical call is a house fire.
Yep.
You know, you go in there, hey, you come out. Did you notice that they had four locks on that front door? Did you notice the condition of the floor in that house? I don't know.
How far the setback is from the road.
Yeah.
When I was riding backwards, I knew every residential in my area was about 75 feet from the truck.
Yeah.
So I knew exactly where if I needed to pull. Now that I got promoted up to chauffeur on the truck, I know the setbacks, where I can put my truck, each department. Any type of apartment fire we catch, I already have a pre-planned spot where I want to set my truck, what windows I can touch, what roofs I can touch, which ladders need to go where. But riding backwards is... That's where it all has to start. If you're not proactive in it.
And if you get a good foundation when you're riding backwards, all that information just carries up with you as you move up the driver, and then when you make officer, and before you know it, I mean you're solid.
Yep.
You're solid. So that's awesome. Okay, cool. Well, we're gonna transition to sizing up hose one to sizing up ladders, which I know is probably a popular topic with this particular crowd. Ironically, we're teaching ladders in recruit school right now at Fire Academy, so pretty excited to fresh. But it's easy because it kind of gives me some perspective on our conversation tonight also, just the importance of that good foundation of ladders. You see these guys and gals, and they're in recruit school, and they're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and you start talking about the ground ladder section of the book. And, I mean, you're just inundated with parts, and most of them have never been on a ladder in their life. And all of a sudden, one day they're doing dress-out drills, and the next day there are 47 bullets of ladder parts. And you can just see the confusion on their face. And then you start talking about angles and all this other stuff, and man, it's like, what?
Perfect climbing.
Perfect climbing. Perfect climbing is the one that doesn't fall. The perfect angle is whichever one goes over the hedgerow that's underneath the window. I got to put a ladder.
Or whichever one. I had that last week, actually.
Yeah.
Threw four ladders, and the last one I threw was the 28th. Second floor over the hedgerow, sitting like that.
Yeah.
Proud of that.
Buried in the grass. So, now we kind of got our little surge in. Let's talk about ladders in general. Ground ladders in general. Is there an urgent need for ground ladders on the modern fire ground?
In most departments, no.
What's that?
Again, like I talked about earlier.
Are we talking about the urgency of needing them on the fire ground, or the urgency of actually using them on the fire ground?
We need them, and we need them more now than ever. But the average department in general doesn't put ladders like they need to, because, I don't know, I think people think it's work. I think people don't train on it, so... You give them a 2-section 24 and tell them to throw it, and they monkey butt it, and they can't throw it, or they don't work out. They sit on the couch a lot, so they can't throw it just due to physical fitness, or they don't know the proper technique to throw it. And it embarrasses them. And like every other person, every other fireman, they don't want to be embarrassed in front of their fellow people.
Absolutely.
I think manpower and staffing and your operational priorities have a lot to do with that also.
Mm-hmm.
Fire
safety.
A lot of people are looking for hose line and tank and get in and get on fire, but in the back of your mind, nobody's looking for that Mayday opportunity when you have to get out. You have to extricate a victim out of the second floor or you're bailing out and there's no ladders there.
That obviously intentionally, JJ and I have, JJ and I were at Spartanburg in 2013. And I was in Spartanburg this year, and we taught VES or VEIS a lot. I mean, JJ, obviously he was on the truck downtown. I mean, he did a lot of VES. I think that we agree that given the information coming out of all this research and our own experiences, that VEIS in the next essentials book, VEIS is going to be a primary search technique in probably the next essentials book. And if it's not, it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Just based on what we're learning about fire behavior, fire growth, heat saturation, the importance of doing a primary search where people are instead of beating ourselves up, going to where the, not trying to find the people, going to where the people are, not
right.
doing a blind search, And I think that, there's a lot to that, personally. I mean, I really think that, in the future, you're going to see a lot of that where the importance of, people right there, okay, cool. The days of engine pulls up, truck pulls up, truck goes in either just ahead or right behind the engine, they advance together. There's a time and a place for that. There always will be a time and a place for that. But I think a forward-thinking truck officer on the inside crew is going to say, you know what? That front door is a traffic jam. If it's a two-story house at 3 o'clock in the morning,
yeah, we're hitting the
tank. We're going to the windows. At one of the departments where I've worked in the past, I mean, that was kind of a fairly routine thing. You pull up, a couple engines were already there. I mean, it was a freaking, wow. I mean, it behooved you to find other means of access.
Yeah.
Even though your primary job as first truck, as the inside crew on the first truck, was search. Okay, well, that's great. I'm pretty sure that anywhere where all 18 of them are is good.
Yeah. You're probably in the fire.
Anywhere where they are is good. So let's go to where they're not, because that's where we're going to find somebody. A lot of times that's going to be via ladders, or how it gets leaned up against the side of the building.
Yeah.
So that being said, even from a fire tech standpoint, do you see maybe in the relatively near future more attack via window?
Especially as you look at cheaper construction, potentially you have the chance of the interior stairwells burning out quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So, hypothetically, I'm just using, because it's the first example that comes to my mind, if you've already got a line inside a first floor,
mm-hmm.
and you can't make the second floor because the stairwells burn out, and I'm sorry, I think we've all done it, but an attic ladder on the burnout stairwell does not work very well. And I've done it, and everyone else I know has done it, but the fact of the matter is, a lot of times it doesn't work very well. I mean, and I think if I can take a step back and look, maybe we should have thrown ladders on. Obviously, ladders were eventually thrown,
mm-hmm.
but, climb the ladder with the line, just like you did in recruit school, get up there and go through the window and go ahead and make your attack from the second floor. You don't have to use the interior stairway if it's already burnt out.
Especially, we get these advanced attic fires, any fire department and any of the firefighters that I associate myself with are the kind of people that if you show up at any fire, we're going to push as far as we can push.
Okay.
Not recklessly, not making bad decisions, but we're going to try to fight our way in and do some work. Okay? That being said, you get one line in the front door, it goes up the stairs. Second line, haven't quite got it yet. Okay, well, here comes the second line. It's starting to run on us. Okay, well, here comes the third. No. So what about throwing ladders to that second floor or whatever, bringing lines 3 and 4
mm-hmm.
over ladder? you know. Do you practice that in Columbia at all, or?
A little bit. I think it's like everything. I will commend ourselves here lately, and I say lately within the past year, with the addition of our truck schools and really pushing our ladders, we have done, and I'm going to pat ourselves on the back, we've done a phenomenal job of laddering every window,
mm-hmm.
every side, our statement in truck school is every floor, every window, every side, you know. There shouldn't be a window untouched. And I commend our engine companies because now our engine companies are pulling up on working fires and dropping their, you know, obviously we have the top-mounted hydraulic ladder racks, which I know a lot of people are going to. Our engineers on our engines, I have to commend them. They are dropping those ladders. So as guys are running out of ladders on the trucks, they're continuously grabbing ladders off the engine. And we have some companies that engineer on the engines, as soon as he sets the line pressure, he's throwing ladders. We are amazing right now in ground ladders. I still won't put us in the category of Boston. Boston is still in a world of their own. But I'll tell you right now, Columbia, we're pushing our way over there. It's amazing. There was a fire, I want to say, about a month and a half ago that a probationary firefighter that was lucky enough to float to one of the trucks. I think he threw 6 ground ladders by himself on the back side of an apartment fire. And this was literally at 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
We're really doing a good job on our recent truck school, something that we push because we get 2 support companies, really 3 support companies on all apartment fires and commercial fires. Is the first 2 truck ladders the A and B side, the second 2 truck ladders the Charlie and Delta side. Now, that is also open to where if you pull up on the Charlie side, well, then, you know, you make the call where it's needed. But at least there's the game plan of saying, hey, if this ladder 1 is laddering the Alpha Bravo side, ladder 2 or whatever company's coming, ladder Charlie Delta side, so that everyone knows what area they cover. They go out, find ladders. And when we run out of ladders, you go to the engine. When the engines are out of ladders, well, we're just out of ladders. We need more companies. And truly, from a spec standpoint, which I don't want to drag out the whole ladder spec thing issue, but when we have to start calling additional companies for ladders because our trucks aren't spec'd right, then maybe things can get fixed.
Sure.
If you start running out of stuff, then maybe things change.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. And you actually... Obviously, you know, just to ask you, not to put you on the spot, but really to kind of put you on the spot, what's the main purpose? And Aaron, you actually brought this up also. What's the main purpose of throwing those ladders? Is it to rescue somebody from every floor and every window?
No, because it makes good pictures.
It doesn't make epic pictures, actually. It makes awesome pictures.
No, it's because it's for us, and that's the one thing that I think a lot of people need to make in their head, and especially we tried in our last truck school we had last 2 months ago, is those ladders are for us. The ladders are for us. Yes, they are for the rescue, but I think we all know if we see someone hanging out the window, there's going to be ladders there. But it's for us. It's for the people operating on the floors, whether there's fire or smoke there right now or there in 20 minutes. It's for us in case something happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people are like, well, there's no smoke up here. Well, what happens if
it doesn't mean 3 minutes?
Yeah. 3 minutes there's no smoke, or if Matt McDowell has chest pains up there and he needs to get out, why does he need to go through the whole interior of this park when he can walk down the ladder safe?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, when things... Thank you. Well, yeah, that's it's really just my broken heart from everything you just said.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, but, you know, I think that's kind of the weird thing, I guess, is that, you know, these ladders are for us, you know. I mean, they're for us, period. There's no gray area. There's no, you know, they're for us to get in, and they're for us to get out. Sometimes us getting out means bringing somebody else with us, bringing the victim with us. But, I mean, we're going in. Again, if you throw one ladder and I go in that ladder, if I know that that's the only ladder that's getting thrown, that means that no matter what I do on the inside, I got to find my way back to that ladder.
Okay.
Instead of knowing that, you know, that our department's culture is, hey, let's just say your priorities are close to the fire room,
yep,
floor above the fire room, and then out from there.
Yep.
Because those are our prior priorities, right? I mean, it's like everything else.
Yep.
So when I go up and I search, I know that those ladders are going progressively away, so if things start to get 40, our engines don't have to try to bail out to the front door of an apartment. They can bail into a room, because what we know about fire behavior now is that things change very rapidly. They don't have to find their way out. They just got
to
find their way
to
out of that area into another area. And if that's a room with a window, then they're out, period. So, yeah, or just get resources up there. Hey, well, you know, we could really use some extra hooks up here. Okay, and then you got to find some poor schlub to hike him up the stairs and walk. Or you can just walk to the window and go, hey.
Yep.
And hand them up. Or bring them up. Or hook them on the top rung. Hey, your hooks are outside the window for you. I mean, there's lots of functional reasons. Safety is obviously the number one. So, yeah. So, that being said, we know that we need them, right? Things get serious a lot faster for us. You know, it's kind of like we either get on it or we kind of, you know, have to work at it. I know that, you know, we all share the mentality of staying ahead of where we are. If you're in the moment, you're behind. Right? If you're not one step ahead, then you're one step behind. But that being said, getting the ladders there is one thing. Like, to the scene is one thing. Having enough ladders, and I'm trying to pull up a picture. Of course, it's not working. That would be too easy. The link actually worked when I needed it to. But the resources there, getting the ladders there, training your guys, the ladders is one thing. But what about sizing up the ladder? How do we know, how do you, because, you know, most ladder trucks, either by design or by default, if you didn't design it and you just got the NFPA stock set, right? You might have, let's just say, if it's like the NFPA stock set, you're going to have, what, a 35, a 24, two 16s, and a folding ladder,
right,
and an attic ladder. All right, that's pretty much the NFPA stock. Okay. Well, if that's all you got, then you can't necessarily just arbitrarily throw your ladders around.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to know, okay, well, I got this ladder, it's got to go here. You know, a 16-foot roof ladder has a longer bed section, well, not bed section, but a 16-foot roof ladder is longer than the bed section of a 24.
Right.
You got to know that.
Right.
And when you size up what you're going to throw, you might actually throw a 16-foot roof ladder in that scenario to a taller window than your 24.
Right.
Given the situation.
Right.
Obviously, in that scenario, you're not extending the 24. But if you got just a boatload of ladders, or, like you said, you know that, you will, like, Irma's a good example. You got a 35, right?
On our truck, carry 235, 228, 216, attic ladder. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so, but why don't you have any 24s on the truck?
Because they have 28. They thought it would be a better idea to put 28 on them so we could reach third floor.
Third floor windows, which is where we're going next.
Right.
And what do all your engines carry?
24. Yeah.
Right? So, so again, it's knowing what you have, knowing what's coming, knowing where to get what you need. You know, my, one of the things that I like to bring up in our trains when we start talking about ladders is the, is really sizing up the window itself, all right? We're taught in building construction, you know, that a residential floor is 8 to 10 feet, commercial floor is 10 to 12 feet. Well, I know that where I am, I mean, even the cheap houses have 9 to 10 foot ceilings.
Right.
You know, in the not-so-cheap houses, I mean, I don't even know if we have a hook on any of our apparatus that can reach the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm sure there are those houses in everybody's area, right? But that being said, they're building apartments with at least 10 feet from ground to floor, if not more, more like 12 feet. So you said for your third floor apartments, you need a 28-foot ladder to reach the windows of the third floor apartments, and that's kind of where I'm going with this. Is, you know, if you just go by simple, like by the numbers, let's just say that, you know, in newer construction, they're building these apartment buildings. Because, I mean, let's be realistic. I mean, the most epic ladder pictures that are out there are these large apartments with, you know, fire blowing out, and they're just ladders, just beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. But in that multifamily dwelling where there's a bunch of windows that need to get ladders, there's a bunch of people that need to get out. In these newer buildings, where they're more like 10 feet, where they have 10-foot ceiling, that makes it 11 to the next floor. Right off the rip, you know, which makes it about 14 to the windowsill. So if it's built off the ground, you're at 15 feet. Now, it used to be you would throw your roof ladders to the second floor window to save your extension ladders for the upper floor for the third floor.
Yeah.
Well, now all of a sudden, the second floor window is taller, is higher than our roof ladders are long. Not to mention if it's built on any kind of a crawl space, or if it's got a basement. I mean, you probably have that a lot more than I do down in the low country. I mean, you'd be living in a fishbowl if you have a basement. That's where I am. But we do have houses built up because we have the opposite problem. We have, you know, the hurricane stuff and, you know.
Right.
So all of a sudden, you are riding in, you're on the truck, you get a sign up, I'm on scene. Actually, the house we had the other day. Three-story house on pilings.
The pilings are about 15 feet, aren't
they? Usually. I mean, it depends on the water table and, like, kind of where, you know, your relationship, you know, are you in, like, a really low area, or are you kind of on a bluff a little bit?
That's what it needs for extension ladders on your ladder trucks really
coming in. Oh, absolutely, you know.
So much.
So now, all of a sudden, you roll up just by just the way it's built now, that roof ladder isn't going to even get you to the second floor window.
It gets you up to the first floor.
Yeah. You know.
The porch.
So now you're sitting there and you're like, okay, if you do the math, like you said, if you want to, so you have to use a 24 to get to the second floor window. Well, now you got a three-story apartment building. I mean, you're 23, 24 feet to that windowsill. 24 foot's not going to get to there.
Mm-hmm.
So now, and again, it's kind of where I was going with this, is, you know, our traditional laddering complement emphasizes 24s. It's 35 to 24s. You rarely see 20, I mean, you don't see 20, 28 that much, right? And I've always loved two-section 28.
Mm-hmm.
Loved. Wow.
Oh, you're keeping alkali?
Absolutely. I'll carry it. Hey, with the right amount of fire and the right amount of adrenaline, I'm throwing anything. I'm throwing any wreck.
Yeah,
fit
there.
Right. But, you know, but yeah, I mean, like I've always thought that 28-foot ladders were significantly underutilized.
Right.
And I've thrown your 28. One of my other times I rode up here, we cut the little apartment over in Lexington when John Warner was doing this out of the attic. I'm just gonna roll with it. All right. I didn't hang up the call. Doesn't look like I did. But anyway, so 28-foot ladders, I think are kind of underutilized. You know, my personal opinion is that it's something that, as a fire service, we need to maybe look at. I think I know. It would be very easy for me to find out if I really wanted to, but in Charlotte, from what I understand, their engines have two ladder racks. They have the typical 24-foot and attic ladders, and then on the other side, and this has been a while ago, so I don't even know if this is still what they're actually speccing. And then on the other side, they have another rack that has a 35-foot on it.
I think they carry 40s now.
40s?
I believe.
But again, I mean, is that because somebody said, wait a minute, these ladders aren't really giving us the reach that they used to?
Right. Especially if they're setting up for the downtown end.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, if you heard enough, but we're actually teaching Forest Wesley for the Fair Climb.
I'll be there.
And we're actually doing the Fair Climb.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We'll all get together.
Yeah. So, yeah. See, if you've been on time for the show, you would have even known this.
I'm learning about it, we're changing.
So, but anyway. But again, you know, we're kind of on a tangent about the 28-foot ladders, but, you know, that translates over to your 35s also, because I'll throw the crap out of a 2-section 35 myself.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. But it's just out of necessity because, you know, again, having worked in an area where the need is there, and they said, look, if you want to ride on that, that needs to get up by yourself, because we have over 300 feet of ground ladders. Other people will be laddering themselves. So that's your job.
Yeah.
Get that ladder up. And again, with the right amount of fire, right amount of adrenaline, things get a lot easier. But you can still get hurt doing it if you don't know the technique.
Yeah.
And you talked about really physical conditioning, right? One of the things that, to kind of wrap up the whole sizing of the ladders, you know, getting out in your district and realizing, wait a minute, this 24 isn't going to get me where I think it's going to get me. I mean, we have a lot of two-story roofs. The 24 isn't going to get you on the roof.
Yeah, we had first floor fire at the motel on the roof a couple months back. Boy, I was driving the truck. I was on the roof, actually, riding roof man that night, and he threw a 24, tried to throw it to the third floor balcony, and I left there. She pulled it out and went through all of that trouble, and it landed short of the second floor.
It just goes back to being, you know, just going around looking up from your smartphone and getting smarter by looking out the window.
Yeah.
You know, because if you're looking out the window when you're riding around, you'll see these things. You know, if you're on an uncle call at that apartment complex, you know, like, great day. That's a long way to that freaking balcony up there. Hey, Kev, what size ladder do you think that is? I mean, even if you don't want to do the thinking, have some less do the thinking for you and be like, I think we should probably plan on getting a 35 if we're going to get to that roof, or we need to have a 28 if we're going to get to that balcony.
Yep.
And again, it's simple stuff, and it doesn't have to be an extravagant drill. It can just be simply, hey, what if? And like I said, I'm sure I could do that ladder.
Oh, you got the drill.
Really wish that he would have had just one what if before that fire happened.
Yeah. You don't ride my truck and not know what how to do your job. Take the job serious because everybody looking at you is taking you serious. So he would be next shift. All he did was ladders.
Absolutely. No, you know, but that's, you know, that's the kind of reinforcement that we need.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, anyway, now, besides not realize that new construction, the dimensions are changing on it. You know, you can't say it's 8 feet per floor in a residence and 10 feet per floor at a minimum. That's bumped up to 9 and at least 12 at a minimum. But again, learn your district. If your district isn't going through a whole lot of growth, then you might not have that problem. But if you are, then you need to get out and figure these things out before they're on fire. That being said, we talked about getting in shape and throwing ladders. You know, one of the things that I talked to the recruits about today.
Wow, pick that out.
Because it was kind of the end of the day, you know, and it was hot today. I mean, we were sweating bad, and you know, it was perfect for a teaching moment. And those guys are out there, and they're sweating like mad, and they're tired, and they're out there, and it's their first day of hands-on with ladders, and their technique stunk.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just trying to rest the ladders up because they're tired. They've lost their patience. They were reminded, you know, the ladder, you know, don't wear yourself out throwing a ladder. Because in reality, the ladder gets you to where the work is.
Right.
Yep.
You know, and even though I know that in our classes, you know, we really emphasize and we train people to throw everything one firefighter because that's realistic. That's realistic, whether it's a 35. I'm not gonna drop her name just in case you don't want me to, just in case she's listening. But we had a female firefighter in our veterinary search class in Southeastern. Yeah. She's actually been to. Well, no, this is actually
right. The first.
Yeah. But she, a very petite female.
That's 90 pounds.
Yeah. Very petite female. You know, but again, it's not about your gender. It's not really even about the build, because she was out laddering men that had 50 pounds on her easy. And a lot of it was, and it's just like we told her, because, you know, she was struggling at first with the ladders because, I mean, 5'5", 90 pounds,
mm-hmm.
All hard.
It's a lot of hard.
But she's like, I can't do this ladder. I was like, that's not an excuse because you have to do that ladder. And what we told her was, you know, figure it out. Find the technique that works for you. You know, these are the fundamental steps that we have to follow to keep you safe, to keep it effective. But outside of that, if you got to drag it to where you're going, and then, you know, obviously you're not going to plant it in the yard and walk it up, but if you got to put it against the building and just monkey it up, then that's what you got to do.
Yep.
But again, you just, the physics of it was she didn't obviously have a lot of leverage because she was relatively short. She didn't have a lot of weight to throw into it, which, you know, a lot of firefighters rely, and a lot of these recruits today were relying on just their sheer strength.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them, I'm like, boys, I'm giving you, you know, we're throwing 14-foot roof ladders for technique. Tomorrow we're throwing 35s. So you need to figure out the technique today.
Yeah.
So I don't care if you can throw that with a pinky. Today we're doing proper lifts, proper lowers, proper technique, proper commands to this recruit school.
The essential.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you're not going to – I wouldn't teach somebody. And this kind of segues into the next part about, you know, you know, what are the book versus the street considerations of throwing ladders, right? You know, but what are kind of what I kind of thought to go with it. But tomorrow, when we get into the heavy ladders, and you try to do it that shortcut way, you're gonna be in a world of hurt.
Yeah.
Because not only is it wrong for evaluation purposes. That's just where they are right now. It's hard on you. And, you know, that's kind of when I brought up the fact that, you know, this thing just gets you to where you start the work. So if you think you're going to show up at a fire and just wrestle a bunch of ladders up and then get called to do a search, sit your back there, ladder to the roof and go cut a hole. And you've been using poor technique and just muffling up and your shoulders are shot now, it's not going to happen. And what I was going to say was, and we can do this in our class. As a matter of fact, we even, like, kind of readjusted the class on the fly because some of their technique was so bad. And we're like, we're not going to teach them, quote-unquote, advanced ground ladders until we reinforce their basics. You know? So even though... you know, sizing up ladders, having the physical strength to just do it. It's not even just about the physical strength to carry the ladders and to raise the ladders. It's about being able to actually do it as a means to an end, getting a ladder up so you can go cut a hole in the roof, or getting a ladder up so you can start your search on the second floor. laddering a window to take bars off. And now, you know, if you're using a power saw, that's 20, 25 pounds that you're holding out like this after you just threw a few ladders. And the technique of getting a ladder business saves you a whole bunch. So let's talk about kind of the book versus the street consideration. Yeah, the jump off points are going to be the pull pin.
Street wins all the time.
Yeah, street definitely.
Okay, so right after it, what's the number one difference between bookland and street? From a strategy standpoint, from a tactical standpoint, from a whatever.
Don't be afraid to drag them.
Okay.
Don't follow the 75-degree rule. Don't be afraid to throw them against the ship.
Now, that being said, is there a limit to the 75-degree rule?
I think there could be, but in general, you got to speak till you got to do what you got to do. I'd rather someone can slow down on a bad angle of a ground ladder than no ladder.
Yeah.
There shouldn't be an excuse to not have a ladder.
All right, and so even from a, leading to what would reduce that ladder angle that we take for granted on the training ground? Okay, maybe one more click to slow us down on a ladder slide.
Mm-hmm.
What about, because we talked about before, hedges.
Okay.
Hedges, light posts, fences.
Trees.
Cars.
The terrain itself.
Yeah. I mean, they don't teach the debt you do in recruit school. The debt you do is where you actually throw where you actually put your back to the building and raise it from the top
right.
up.
Right.
And you walk it up the hard way.
Use the car park in the put the ladder.
Where you actually bring the ladder up and under tree branches
power
lines. Cable lines.
Yeah. And it's really tough. If you're bailing out of a window and you're coming out hot. When you bail out on a
figuratively hot or literally hot?
Literally hot. you're just like I'm coming out now. And you're coming out on a 75-degree angle. You leap out. You're going to land about midway to three-quarters down towards the ground on that ladder.
Yeah.
So when you're looking towards your rescue angle, you know, kicking it out a lot more, that's going to help those guys if they do come out of there moving. And then they have more of a chance to actually hit more ladder and so hit more ground.
Yeah.
We know that it's better off.
Yeah. And there are a lot of, if you just do a Google search of firefighter bailout pictures, if you Google or if you YouTube bailout, and you see guys, I mean, the one thing that we know for a fact is that when things get real, we're coming out of the windows and we're coming out head first.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, they have rapid ladder egress, or the other name of it is escape movement, basically where you put your hand. You grab the beam, click, four, slide, come out in like a modified cartwheel.
Yeah.
Obviously, we teach the rapid ladder egress in our rescue and rescue. A few years ago, we finally added head first ladder slide.
Yeah.
And, I always teach, and I can't account for the other guys, but I always say, use the technique. Learn the technique here, because if you go out of the window, this is what you're going to do.
Yeah. You're not going to take the time to step out.
I personally, this is my opinion, I personally view the rapid ladder egress as you're in a hostile environment, kind of like a Denver drill kind of scenario, in a low-staffing situation, which pretty much everybody is, because it's just, you never have enough resources when and where you need them.
Mm-hmm.
And you found the down firefighter, you bring him to the window, and now you've got to at least start the rescue. You can do a rep ladder egress to stay low out of the window, get flipped around, and then lean back in the window to help get that firefighter up into the sill. To me, that's like the main function. Because if I come out of the window, I'm just going. I'm just,
yeah.
If it's gotten that bad,
yeah.
And obviously here in Irmo, everybody, it's close to home here because you guys had a lot of guys in the past pilot, which we talked about in our last show.
Yeah. Actually, 2 weeks before that, my body company, we bailed on the house.
Really?
Same thing. We were making a push on the engine. The guys there that didn't realize the situation was doing what it was doing. Smoke dropped down, the floor banked down on them. They were still set in the old, don't get smoke,
yeah.
Don't open the nozzle
yeah.
up. And it rolled over on them, and they bailed out, burned them up. It happened.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I'm talk about putting water on smoke next time. Because I've got to, because that's got to freaking change. That's got to change. So bailing out happens. I mean, you know, and again, I never, ever look at somebody who bailed out. I wonder what happened to make that situation happen.
Yeah. What did we not do as a team
to
mitigate that situation?
You know, what happened to the condition? Yeah. Or did I see it coming? I did what I thought I was supposed to do, and it still went south on me.
What did I learn from that?
My dad actually survived a bad situation, bad enough to where before he was even out of the building, they'd already called my mom to the scene. Said, you need to get over here. It's not good. Ended up being fine. Scared the ever-living crap out of him for a while, but long story short, they were calling out a long, smoky hallway, cold smoke conditions. Following the smoke, this is back in the early 80s. You know, long coats, hip boots, quasi-related side note, it was actually my dad and my high school drafting teacher, who, for the record, called me Jack the entire semester. What's my dad's name on it and stuff? I started answering Jack. But anyway, the two of them were crawling down a hallway in a Howard Johnson hotel and couldn't find the seat of the fire. Well, they did what we all do. They followed the condition. Well, they started getting in, and the condition started to deteriorate on them to the point where it started getting a little bit soupy on them. So they did what they were trained to do. They recognized that as pre-flashover condition. So they got together, pinned the line, went up, penciled. When they penciled, as short as I can make it, they put a drop ceiling in a sauna. So obviously it wasn't supposed to be there in the first place. And they didn't know it was there. And the fire was above that drop ceiling. So it was starting to break out when they got to that point. And when the conditions got that bad, they penciled. When they penciled, they basically vented where the fire was.
Mm-hmm.
And things went south pretty quickly. But again, they reverted to their training. And again, you know, this is the wide fog, you know, this is, you know, kind of at the heart of the fog versus smoothbore. They went wide fog and just, because that's all they could do. But again, this just kind of goes to the, you know, we talk to the guys about not putting fire on smoke, you know, are we teaching guys about recognizing flashover? Are we training guys on what to do when things go south? You know, in your guys' case, last year, you know, I think, at face value, it looked like things went wrong, but you guys did a heck of a lot of things right. You know, and I'm sure you have lessons learned, and we actually talked about it on our last show in May. But, again, in this job, you can do everything right and things still go wrong. You know, so, you know, we throw ladders for egress for us. We throw them at the right angle for us, you know. And that angle isn't always, like you said, that angle isn't always the book angle. Sometimes it's slightly exaggerated. Sometimes because of landscape, it has to be steep because there's a tree right outside the window and that's all you can get. But you get what you get, you know, because still, some ladder is better than no ladder. But again, with that comes that responsibility to know what ladders will reach what, how to get them there. And like we talked about, do we need to start to rethink our ladder complements? Everybody in with all due respect to the manufacturers, if you say send me a ladder truck and you don't specify what ladders come on it, if it's a ladder truck, well, if it's a pumper, you're getting a 24, a 14, and a roof. If it's a ladder truck and you don't specify what ladders, it's a 35, a 24, a 16, maybe, or 216, a combination ladder and an attic ladder, because that's what MFPA says you have to have.
Yeah, I think the Essentials way compared to the Street Smart way, I think it's just a great way to teach new people how to make that, set that ground layer, get that. Anything for it, I'm thinking about foundation. You have to, it's like any, we've all been told about fire thing, you don't show up and set a strong foundation, you're going to lose it. You know, you have to start out with a solid plan and everything. So setting, doing ladders by the Essentials and setting up that, at least when it gets on the fire scene and everything's going haywire, they'll have that foundation to revert back to. So they will have something. Then once you get guys on the floor for 6 months and a year and they start calming down and it's not just a straight adrenaline shot, you know, that's when you can really start drilling in that street spot and they start seeing the big picture of what your thing will do.
Absolutely. You know, it's, and, you know, we talked about, you know, street smart laddering, you know, and you said it well about being able to establish the foundation. You know, what makes the street smart, in my opinion, and I know that Chris is actually at home listening because he keeps chiming in on the Facebook page. But Chris took a class from Mike Champo from FDNY at FDIC a while ago, and one of the little nuggets that he brought back was Champo said, you know, he doesn't call them tricks in the trade because they are the trade.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I agree with that.
Call
them knowing your job.
Knowing your job, you know, those aren't tricks, that's the job, you know. You know, when we teach our force entry and we say, yeah, you use the axe as a placeholder, to us, that's not a trick. That's how you force a door, you know. But you can't saturate recruits with too much information. And at the end of the day, if they don't know the parts of the ladder, if they don't know what angle to throw the ladder, like what that goal is, what the objective is. The objective is to get this ladder to that location at approximately this angle. And this is pretty much, under ideal conditions, the way to get it there. In less than ideal conditions, if they can't do it under perfect conditions, they're not going to be able to do it in not perfect conditions. But at least if that foundation is built, like you were saying, they know where they have to adjust
to be extremely close
to get to that objective. You know, and that's not a trick. It's not. That's the street smart aspect of it. Is now I know what I need to adapt to get to that objective.
And like fly in, fly out.
Yeah.
Dual safety on their website. You can set 4%. Lose 4% of the weight.
Yeah.
So when someone's hanging out the window or one of your buddies hanging out the window, they're going to fly in to meet 4% and 4% the amount.
Yeah. And I believe ground ladders are tested 500 pounds. Oh. Is that heavy?
They're ready to test it.
Right. But they are tested fly in and fly out.
Yeah.
To the same weight.
Dual safety test on their website.
So
frequently asked questions.
So
the letter there.
Just because, yeah, just make sure that everybody's clear. We're talking about kind of some street smart stuff. A little nugget. Obviously, we're not trying to rewrite your policies, but food for thought. You know, going ladders, one firefighter, we always. You know, it usually comes up in our classes about, you know, fly in, fly out. Do you, when you throw the 24-foot by yourself, normally, usually you throw it fly in and then you flip it into place. Well, there's not always a need to do that. If you can just get it up there, and if, especially if the circumstances are such to where you pull up, it's rocking and rolling, and you're moving with a purpose with a ladder in each hand, or a couple ladders in each hand, and you're just trying to, and you're laddering like it's your job, because, well, it is. You know, throwing it, flipping it, you know, maybe the position of that ladder, maybe it's that window, maybe, you know, if it's a dormer window, maybe you can't flip it, you know, if that dormer is set back, you know, because there's something on either side, or whatever the case is, or there's obstacles in the yard that won't let you do it, or whatever the case is. Not being afraid, not knowing your equipment enough to know that, hey, it's tested, fly in and fly out. I'm going to roll. I'm going to roll with this. It's good. I know it's good. It's tested. We're good. But, again, it's manufacturer-specific, and you can't follow, you know, and we would never encourage anybody to not follow your department's policies. But just learn your equipment and learn what you can and can't do. You know, what's your department's position on dragging ladders? I know that I will drag ladders until somebody tells me to stop.
Yep, and then I'll laugh at
them. You know, because I know that I can probably stack, you know, I can probably stack three ladders
mm-hmm.
and still and nest my tools in them, chicken wing them, and drag those while carrying at least one other ladder or another tool or a saw. And I'll drag those around the fire ground to wherever I need them and roll with it. And I can throw ladder for egress and ladder to roof and do work in one trip. Again, you got to find out what the flavor of your department is. But personally, I promote dragging ladders, especially when it comes down to, like, saving energy, especially in your you got to stand by for a second. Y'all can bear with me real quick. They just got boxed out to smoke in an apartment. All right, everybody. I appreciate it. We're back. Yeah, you don't want to forget that.
Taking my belt.
Speaking of truck belts. Aaron had to run back in and get it. All right, so I'm Lone Ranger now. JJ is working as a duty officer tonight, so he's what are we talking about? We're talking about street smart laddering, dragging ladders. You know, it's I personally have no problem at all with dragging ladders. I think it's at the end of the day, it's whatever you need to do based on your staffing, based on your training level, experience level to get the job done. Again, we would never promote breaking your policy. So again, before you start doing stuff that, you know, might not be practiced very often in your organization, maybe put out some feelers and see how it'll be received. Because we definitely don't want to see anybody get jammed up. But again, on the fire ground, you know, we have a job to do. You need to be able to build on the foundation that you got in recruit school or recruit training, or, you know, if you took it as an in-house class, just whatever the case is. You know, building that foundation is absolutely vital because at the end of the day, being street smart is about, you know, doing and realizing what you need to do to get the job done to that objective. So that being said, we're going to wrap up ground ladders, and we're going to take a quick break and wrap it up.
When we put out fires, it ain't the metaphor kind, kid. That's why I use Grainger. They got everything. They got Bullard helmets, Cosmos boots, Elkhart brass nozzles. And on top of it all, Grainger's got the inventory management solutions to keep the heat off the books. Heck, they've got just about everything you need for the fire station, except the trucks. When you think fire rescue, you think Grainger. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Grainger.com/public safety or stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, we're back. We're going to wrap it up real quick. Had a good show tonight. Had some good discussion. We We talked about truck belts, which is a fun little talk, a little bit of nostalgia, which is always a good thing. Hold on a second. All right, so we talked about truck belts, which was a fun little chat. We also talked about the importance of sizing up hose stretches, of making sure that your estimate of hose is accurate. It's not only key to keep you safe, but make sure that we can accomplish our ultimate mission, which is putting the fire out, making sure that you don't end up getting yourself in a bind by not adequately sizing up your hose stretch and falling short. We also emphasize the importance of drilling on different methods of advancing line, extending line, both in the yard and in hallways, in smoke and things like that. So, just drilling until, until you find the lost art of engine work. Don't fall victim to pre-connect syndrome. Get out there and train on that. And then finally, we talked about ladders. We talked about, the importance of establishing a solid foundation, being taught the right way to throw ladders because of their weight, being able to work smart, use the techniques that are out there to get them in place, get them working right. That way you conserve your energy to do the work that the ladders are there to get you to. We're most of the time, unless you're fortunate to have the staffing to where somebody is riding the ladder seat on the truck, where their only job is throwing ladders, most of us have to throw that ladder to get us to where the work is. So having that foundation, having the technique to conserve your energy for being able to do what you need to do is very important, but also having that foundation to be able to work street smart and know, based on the fundamental way of throwing a ladder, what you need to adapt to get the job done when the situation is not sterile. When you're out in the real world and that ladder has to be there, but you have an obstacle, whether it be hedges, whether it be overhead lines, whether it be trees, whatever the case is, being able to get the job done. So, and then, kind of going along with that, being able to pay attention, kind of like with estimating the hose stretch, being able to estimate what kind of ladders you're going to need, knowing what complement you carry on your rigs, knowing what your mutual aid companies carry on their rigs, knowing when the ladders that you carry may not reach. The importance of understanding trends in building construction in your jurisdiction, to know when ceiling heights and building heights in your area are starting to exceed your ground ladder capabilities. All very, very important. And obviously the common thread to all of that stuff, as usual, is getting out and training. So, all right, so that being said, to recap some of the upcoming events, we got a busy couple of months. September 6th, Fire Ground Search and Fire Ground Survival Refreshers at the Goose Creek. September 12th, we're super excited to teach Forcible Entry 1 at the 2014 Charlotte Firefighters 9/11 Memorial Stair Climb. The stair climb itself has already sold out. Registration for the hands-on training opened today, and I would suspect it's probably going to sell out quickly as well. We are not the only hands-on group there. There are other classes as well. Obviously, we're super excited, but there is some phenomenal training at that event, so check that out. There's a link to that on our Facebook page. That is the 2014 Charlotte Firefighters 9/11 Memorial Stair Climb, and we are teaching forcible entry. September 13th, Chris and I will be doing the stair climb. So we're going to be taking pictures throughout the event and post them on Instagram, which will fire them off to Twitter and Facebook so you can follow our day. Really looking forward to and the brotherhood that I'm sure is going to be enjoyed while it's going while that's happening. So we're super excited about that. September 23rd is Street Smart Shop Talk. It's our next episode of this show. It's September 23rd. And October 4th, we're going back to Goose Creek for another round of fire ground search and fire ground survival. And then November 1st and 2nd, we're teaching Street Smart engine work at the Low Country Fire EMS Weekend in Walterboro. It's a phenomenal event. It actually has lecture and hands-on training for fire and EMS. So no matter what side of the house you're riding on or what type of rig you're on, again, the hands-on lineup is phenomenal. The lecture lineup is phenomenal. So I highly encourage you to check it out. You can find a link to the registration for that on our Facebook page as well. So that being said, we want to thank sponsor Granger for making all this a possibility. And we also we want to thank Fire Engineering for giving us a time spot and allowing us to talk shop with all of you. And with that, y'all have a good night and stay safe. Get it done. No excuses.